In the doctor's opinion, which we just covered, we see the nature of the illness. We see the nature of what this is. In Bill's story, what we're going to see are not just one miracle or two miracles. What we are going to see is we are going to see the constellations of miraculous things coming together so that God could shine His light into the cave that was very dark and very cold of the attic so that we could be here today. We're going to see some things in Bill's story, and what my personal hope is that when we're done here today, it will be less of Bill's story and more of your story. Because if I look at the way Bill drinks, and I look at the way Bill thinks, and I look at the things in Bill's life that are in this unbelievably fantastic story, I see myself. And I see the various things that he did, that he writes about, that I thought were secret unto me. And Bill Wilson was born in East Dorset, Vermont. He, in 1908, when divorce was not very prevalent, his mom and dad split up. His mom became one of the very first women osteopathic physicians. She went to Boston to study osteopathic medicine. His father went to Canada to be in the logging business, and he was raised by Grandma and Grandpa Griffith in East Dorset, Vermont. He never had very much in his life. He was raised in very meager surroundings by his grandma and his grandpa in East Dorset. Let's pick up Bill's story and let's see how these various things come together so that we could be sitting here today. It says here, war fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. We were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. In the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Now the pot that he's talking about is not marijuana. It has nothing to do with marijuana. What it is the people in England at that time considered it extremely bad manners to sit and consume liquor. They would literally stand, hence the term bar, that they would lean against, and the beer, the ale, the beer would come in pints and quarts. And they would have pint pots and quart pots. And as that came over to the States, what would happen is the bartender, when these guys would get a little rowdy from drinking, he'd say, "Watch your pints and quarts down there. You guys are getting a little out of hand." And when that expression came over to the colonies, that became where we get our "watch your P's and Q's," and that's where that expression comes from. "Watch your P's and Q's" is an old drinking thing from England at that time. "Watch your pints and quarts" became "watch your P's and Q's," and that's what that means today, even though we now know where it comes from, but maybe we didn't before. See, you get a little of everything. You get a little etymology here. You get a little of everything. See, it's not just about recovery, huh? All right, ominous, which it really is, though. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation? My talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Now listen to this next line, and before I read it, I want to go back and say one other thing too that I forgot to say before. Sorry about that. Bill's story is divided into two sections. I forgot to say that before. The first 8 pages are of Bill's plunge into his alcoholism, and the second 8 pages are about his recovery affected therefrom. But let's see where it identifies with me. It says here, potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Now, what that means to me is food at a very early age started to confound me and control my life. Every aspect of my life was dictated to by my weight and by the food. And we see Bill Wilson is now flunking his test because of his alcoholism. He is unable to think or write because he is drunk. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. The first victim of addictive behavior is the truth. The first thing that goes out the window is the truth. And what the addiction will do right away is make me a liar. Lying to myself. Did you eat that? Lying to others? No, no, not me. Where's that money? I don't know. It will make me a liar. And so you see right here in Bill's story, you see that the food, or the alcohol, excuse me, is making a liar out of Bill. It's making him do things he would not otherwise do. And so I can relate to that? You bet I can. You bet I can relate to that. And that is exactly what the food will do to me. It will make me into a liar. Let's see where he goes. By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. Now, let's not forget that $1,000 in the 1920s was a heck of a lot of money. It was not bad at all. If you had a decent job, that was a lot of money. If you had a decent job, remember I told you that Dr. Silkworth, not streetcar conductor, not street sweeper, Dr. Silkworth went to work at the town's hospital for $34 a week. So if you had $1,000, that was not too bad, not too shabby. It went into certain securities then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. Bill was not really a New York City stockbroker. What he was he was a New York City stock speculator, and he sold his ideas to other people for a percentage of the profit. He was a very fast talker. He was very sharp. He was cunning, baffling, and powerful, too. And he was an alcoholic. He was cunning, baffling, and powerful, too. And he got this idea that in the 1920s, just as you just saw, now I'm showing you, we just witnessed this in the world as we sit here in 2008, that the stocks would, they were literally, you could take a dart, throw it at the dartboard, invest in the stock, and then on about a 10% margin, it would go up and you'd make money. You know, well, he was thinking, we need some more information here. We need some more solid information on some of these darn companies or we're going to get bit. And they said to him, oh, no, don't worry. What are you, nuts? Yeah, we don't need that. He says, no, I think we do. And he, again, he was cunning, baffling, and powerful too. So, let's see where he goes from there. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success in speculation. So we had a little money, but we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. That is very good. Very good. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. Here he was. He's the darling of Wall Street. He's doing great. He is listened to. He is paid attention to. Let's see where we go. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Could you just imagine? Could you just imagine you give me an opinion today about anything, and not only do I act on it, but I act on it in the tune of millions of dollars. Because you told me something, because it's what you think, because it's what you said to me, I am now investing a fortune of money behind your opinion. Can you just imagine what that must have done to Bill's ego? Could you just imagine? Okay. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Excuse me. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends. Make note of that line, I made a host of fair-weather friends. I'm going to refer to it a couple of three more times. Okay, he's got a couple of friends now. He's got not more than a couple. He's got a lot of fair weather friends. Just the same as if one of the star athletes or one of the star movie stars or a big millionaire from Wall Street came in, if there's any left, if he came in and everybody wants to be his or her buddy, right? Well, that's exactly what Bill Wilson was experiencing. But let's see where he goes very quickly. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. In one sentence, the liquor became preferable than the friends. Everything he ever wanted, he turned his back on for liquor. Every dream he ever dreamed when he was in East Dorset, Vermont, he turned his back on to pursue his drinking. Not consciously, but in the same way I did. I wanted things, I wanted girls, or I wanted riches or wealth. I was acting in the antithesis of that by my eating, and yet I wanted it mentally, and my actions said, let's go the other way on that. Okay, there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Now, we have a book in Alcoholics Anonymous called As Bill Sees It, and we have another book in Al-Anon called As Lois Remembers, and this is one part where they're not the same. In 1980, 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929, all hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription, XYZ 32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to the death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Make note of the line that says, I would not jump. I'm going to refer back to that too. He knew the same thing we just talked about in the doctor's opinion. Even though he might not have been conscious of it, what did he know? Some liquor will take the edge off of this. It will change that perception of reality. When I am eating, I am not in this world. It says we cannot tell the true from the false. It says in the doctor's opinion, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Bill didn't, in his mind, think at that time to jump off the building. He knew that if he drank, he would feel better. He didn't know why yet, but he knew that it would work. Okay. I hope that this is becoming more your story and less Bill's story as we delve into it. Okay. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Liquid courage, right? Give me enough candy and I'm ready to take on the world. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. That would be his friend, Dick Johnson. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job and lost it as the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. Sorry about that. Hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. Now, again, one of the reasons that this is very important for me to take note of is the world that Bill Wilson lived in the 1920s and 30s was not the world we're living in today. We live in a world where everything or most things are very egalitarian. In the world that Bill and Lois lived in, a man supported his wife. A man went out and made a living and provided for his wife. He was home drunk. She was working at a department store, and let me tell you that what she was making would not have filled a tooth. It was very meager wages for women in a department store, especially at that time. So this was very shameful situation for Bill and for Lois as well. The world we live in today, if the woman is the provider and the man is staying home, it's one thing. Then it was totally different. Totally, totally different. Okay. I became an unwelcome hang-around at brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly and I began to awaken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by a half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. When he talks about his periods of sobriety renewing his wife's hope, what he's talking about is he's going on a diet. It's exactly the same thing that I would do periodically. I would say, I've got it now, I'm going on a diet, and for short periods of time, I could diet like a champ. I could diet with the best of them, and I would lose weight. I was young, and I was very fat, so the weight would come off relatively quickly, and people would start to notice. And what would they think? He's got it now. He's smart now. See, he's getting it now. See, he really understands now that there's no good in being morbidly obese. And that's what they would think, because in their mind, why else would anyone eat unless they were crazy? Because the food didn't do for them what the food was doing for me. So they couldn't see it because they didn't feel it. And so when he talks about that, it's very important that I remember that this is my story. And he's going on a diet. And he says he's going to control the situation. He's going to get this under control. How many of us have said to ourselves, I'm going to get this damn it thing. I'm going to control this. And this is going to be my diet. And this is going to be my food plan. And I'm not going to eat anything over and over again. You know, I'm not going to eat anything but what's on this plan. And that's it. I see a lot of heads going up and down. A lot of heads going up and down. This is what he was doing. Okay. Gradually, what happened? Things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage broker. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits, and I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. This is a story within the story. There were people in Cherry Hill, New Jersey that knew how brilliant Bill was at putting these deals together. And they approached Bill Wilson about putting one of these deals together for them. And they were going to cut him in on the profits and he would have to invest nothing. Sounds like a perfect storm because he wants to make money and he wants to make good. And they approached Bill and they said, hey Bill, can you put this thing together for us? And he said, of course I can. And they said, you know, but there's one little thing. You know, Bill, you've got a little problem with booze. Now, Bill, as I just read, was on one of his diets. And when Bill told them, oh, no, you don't have to worry about that anymore. I'm done with that stupid drinking. No more of that drinking for me. They met in a room in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and they passed around a jug of moonshine. Now, there wasn't one person in that room that knew anything about alcoholism, didn't know about a solution, didn't know about the illness. And they passed around a jug of moonshine. And Bill Wilson said, oh, no, I'm not drinking. And then it came around again. And the guy sitting next to him says to him, hey, Bill, I made this myself. This is Jersey Lightning. This was in the days of Prohibition. Now, it'd be like your aunt or your neighbor or somebody saying, hey, I made this pie myself. All the ingredients are natural. Everything in there was homemade, handmade from scratch, right? No sooner than that, Bill Wilson took a slug out of that jug of Jersey Lightning, and let's see where he goes from there. The chance vanished. He was drunk. He had a physical allergy. They didn't. He was drunk. They weren't. Chance gone. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. I was through forever. Dieting again. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. This time I'm going to stick to my diet. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, going back on my diet, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself that I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. And how many times did I do that? And how many times did you do that? I'm off my diet. I've broken the fast. I've broken the diet. I might as well eat everything in sight, and I'll get back on track tomorrow. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight, and all night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? So the other page that we read, he's looking down on the people that are jumping off the building. He's making fun of the people that are trying or thinking of killing themselves. And here he is, because of the hopelessness of this condition, he is contemplating suicide himself. So very quickly he goes from looking down on them, going to the bar. What's he thinking here? He's thinking, I think I'll kill myself. Okay. No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. When I read that line, I have to think back of what my mind and my body withstood from the onslaught of this disease. I'm having my hip replaced in October. It's a miracle I'm not having my whole skeletal system replaced in October. I was putting a hippopotamus on my shoulders and carrying that hippopotamus everywhere I went. I sat down. I got up. I laid down. I got up. I walked. I stood. I did everything with a hippopotamus on my back. The mind, the loneliness. I went on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years old. The loneliness, the absolute emotional deprivation of knowing I was only comfortable with food and knowing I didn't want to be with food. Knowing that the one thing I sought out would kill me. The hopelessness, the suicidal thoughts, the absolute knowledge in the pit of my stomach that says, I'm being victimized here. Why me? Why me? Why? Why not me? Okay. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison. Here again, he's contemplating suicide. Cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. body. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. And I've heard people in OA say, well, gee, I don't really relate to that 40 pounds underweight. Oh, really? How about being hundreds and hundreds of pounds overweight? Isn't that just as unhealthy? How about being underweight if you're an anorexic or a bulimic? Isn't that just as unhealthy? How about doing the things that were just as unhealthy with food as Bill was doing? It was very unhealthy that he didn't eat. It was very unhealthy that I never stopped. And so when I read that line, can I relate to that line? You bet I can. Having contact dermatitis, cellulitis, staph infections, having the absolute unbelievable plague of this illness ransack my life, you better believe it's just as unhealthy as him being 40 pounds underweight. So as I read this, it becomes more and more my story, and so I can wrap myself around it, and that's very important for me to do. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, hold on, I gotta open this here, or I'm gonna die. Sorry about that. Okay, sorry about that. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. That would be the Towns Hospital in New York City. And what we are going to now see is the beginning of what I describe as a series of miracles. We are going to see him placed in the town's hospital, and he is going to come under the care of William Silkworth, William Duncan Silkworth. Okay. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a drug used somewhat like what Valium is used today to kind of fool the body into thinking that it had alcohol in it so that these guys would stop shaking. Hydrotherapy, they would just put him in a room and zip up a bathtub and run hot and cold running water on him, and it didn't do anything but make him a clean drunk. It didn't solve their alcoholism. And mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained, though certainly selfish and foolish, next line is vital, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. Now, we do not know if Bill Wilson is the very first person that Dr. Silkworth gives this information to of the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. For what we are going to find out, and by our meeting here this afternoon, we are going to prove that Bill is the first human being in the history of this planet to act on that information. But in order for him to act on that information, there's some other things that are going to have to come into place. There's some other things that are going to happen, and they will. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. That's a very important line. Many of you in this room and I have done miraculous things. Things that we accomplished that really were wonderful, but we could never stop compulsively overeating by ourselves. Though it remains strong in other areas, my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Now that he knows, he's cured, right? Just like if I told you this is the food plan and this is this, you're cured, right? No, okay. I didn't think so. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining in moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. So Lois is with him. We're going to learn that Bill Wilson is hospitalized for his alcoholism 3 times. This is the second of the 3 hospitalizations that he is going to have for his alcoholism. And he is there, and he is just coming to, and Lois Wilson and Dr. Silkworth are having a conversation in the doorway. And Lois is crying, and she's asking Dr. Silkworth what my mom asked doctors, maybe what your mom asked doctors, maybe what your relatives asked doctors. Isn't there something we can do for him or her? They're such good people. They're so wonderful. What can we do to get them to stop eating this way? And Dr. Silkworth knew nothing could be done. He did not know how to give Bill the moral psychology that he talked about, the spiritual awakening that we hear about. He didn't know anything about that. And he's saying to Lois, he's going to develop a wet brain, which is really a dry brain, but it's a very serious condition. These guys literally turn into houseplants. They literally, the brain, alcohol takes moisture, takes water out of the cells. And the brain cannot rehydrate itself. And so these guys get what's called a wet brain, but it's really not. It's a dry brain. And these guys can live like that in an institution literally for decades. Literally. I mean, they change their diaper and they feed them and they come in and the relatives cry because they don't know them and they don't recognize anything. They're there, but they're not there kind of thing. It's a very serious condition, and it just breaks your heart. Okay. And Bill's hearing this. Bill is listening to them talking, and he doesn't want this, but he doesn't know what else to do. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. There he is, welcoming death again. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark. Excuse me, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before, I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched all around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And I talked about that before. I had met my match. Food was my master. I didn't know what else to do, but I knew one thing. I wanted more food. And as much as it didn't make any sense, in the face of all the pain I had been through, in face of all the loneliness and all the torture that food had caused me, I wanted more of it. When I was a little boy, maybe 10, my mom used to go on Lawrence and Kedzie in Chicago and get a live chicken on Friday. And they would slaughter it. And my mom would come home with the chicken and she would take the feathers out. They'd have the little pin feathers and she'd take them out and she'd make a soup and she'd make all this other stuff. And then when my dad came home, he had this big butcher knife and he knew how to maximize the value of that chicken by cutting it the right way. He knew just what he was doing. And he'd get his old butcher knife out and he'd just start sharpening it up on that big stone. It looks like a sword kind of thing. And he knew what he was doing. And one day when I was 10 or 11 years old, I was home alone and I decided to make a sandwich and I was going to use my dad's butcher knife to cut me a sandwich. And I took that thing out and sliced right into my finger. And I've got the scar there to this day. That knife hurt me and I bled and I cried. That knife hurt me to the point where for the rest of my life I'm very careful around knives and I never touched his butcher knife again, I promise you. Now the food burned me, tortured me, beat me down. That food beat me unmercifully. and yet I can't seem to recall the pain that it caused me from a day or a week or a month ago. And left to my own devices, I will seek it yet again. I will gravitate to it again. And the mental obsession will tell me that this time it won't hurt me. That this time it will be okay. That this time it will be different. That this time I will be able to control it when I eat it, and I'll just have a few. This is not Bill Wilson's story. This is my story. This is my story. Okay. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink, and on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. Here's some more promises here. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Now, what's about to happen? There's a story beyond the story. And the story is going to go back to a man whose family was very, very wealthy. A man whose name was Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard was a man whose family was from Rhode Island. And in Rhode Island, they were industrialists. They had factories. They were very, very wealthy people. And Roland Hazard, in the late 1920s, early 1930s, he wanted to give his parents the gift of sobriety. Seeing him sober, he was an absolutely hopeless alcoholic. And he sought out who was then the preeminent psychiatrist in the world, and the preeminent psychiatrist in the world that he tried to get some help was Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud was not taking any new patients at that time, and Roland could not get in to see him. The second leading psychiatrist was a direct protege of Freud's, and Roland sought him too, and his name was Dr. Adler. Dr. Adler could not see Roland because he was not taking any new patients at that time. Roland sought out the third leading psychiatrist in the world, a man who lived in Sweden, and his name was Carl Jung. And Carl Jung treated Roland for a year. And he treated Roland and he psychoanalyzed Roland for a year. And he told Roland at the end of the year that he was good to go back to the United States, that he had been analyzed, that he had been worked with, he had been cured. He was okay. Now, Dr. Jung didn't know anything about alcoholism, and neither did Roland. But something very strange happened in the shipyard, because Roland didn't get on an airplane to come home. He got on a boat, because air travel wasn't then what it is today. He went to the shipyard to go back to New York City, and he was drunk as a skunk and never made it on the boat. He goes back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung gives Roland some very bad news. He says, "I've misdiagnosed you, Roland. You are an alcoholic." Now, he could have said to him, "You've got a Valium deficiency and I'll psychoanalyze you for another year," because Roland was a wealthy boy. But he didn't do that. He was too much of a professional and too much of an honest man to do that. He wouldn't do it. And he said to Roland, "You are an alcoholic of the hopeless variety and you're going to die." And Roland cried out to Dr. Jung in much the same way we've heard others crying out in this book and in our lives. And Roland said to Dr. Jung, "Is there nothing you can do for me, doctor? I don't want to die." Now, had Roland got to Freud, Freud believed that all solutions lie within the mind. Adler was his close protege. Adler believed that all solutions lie within the mind. But Jung broke ranks with them in one area and one area only. Jung told Roland, "Oh yes, I have heard of spiritual phenomena, spiritual experiences that occur randomly. He didn't know how to cause them. He didn't know how to bring them about. And in these isolated phenomena, the people that have been struck with these spiritual experiences have been altered. They have been changed. They have been rearranged. Their behaviors, their attitudes, their ideals have been rearranged and changed." And Roland says, "How do I do it? What do I have to do?" And Dr. Jung says, "I don't know." Now, at the very height of their existence, there comes another part of the miracle, because Roland, armed with this information, makes it back to New York. But he wasn't a churchgoer per se. He didn't really want to go to church. What he did do was something else. In New York City, there were a group of people practicing Christianity, first century Christianity, to the very best of their ability, called the Oxford Group. The Oxford Group was not concerned at all with alcoholism. They weren't concerned with defining it or treating it or anything. These were people that were in a movement to revitalize and re-energize first century Christianity. They were founded by an Episcopalian minister named Frank Buckman. Frank Buckman believed that what Christianity lacked was enthusiasm. And so he passed that to one of his people, one of his proteges, named Sam Shoemaker. And Sam Shoemaker in New York City ran the Cavalry Mission. The Cavalry Mission in New York City, and Sam Shoemaker later became one of Bill Wilson's very close spiritual advisors and spoke at AA conventions. Sam Shoemaker ran the Cavalry Mission, and there were people there from the Oxford Group, and Roland goes into the Oxford Group and joins the Oxford Movement, and he starts making friends. And one of the friends that Roland made was a guy by the name of Shep Cornell. And one of the friends that Roland makes is a guy by the name of Sebra Graves Jr. And Roland is in the Oxford Group, and he's doing the things that Oxford groupers do. And months are going by, and Roland is sober. He's practicing first century Christianity to the best of his ability, and he is sober. He makes a friend, as I've said, Sebra Graves Jr., and another friend, Shep Cornell, and Roland Hazard's parents say to Roland, "You are doing great. You are doing great. You are working. You are doing fantastic. Take a little vacation. Take a little break." And his friend, Sebra Graves Jr., says to Roland, "You know, Roland, I'm going home to visit my folks in East Dorset, Vermont. Why don't you come with me?" Roland says, "I think I will." Well, if they had gone the week before, I'd be in a piano case outside Chicago. If they went the week after, I'd be in a piano case outside Chicago. But they happened to go the week that something else was happening. Is it odd, or is it God, that these things are coming together because something else is happening? The mayor of Albany, New York, was Mayor Thatcher. And he had a son named Edwin Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby Thatcher was a drinking buddy of Bill Wilson's from years before. Bill and Ebby did a lot of drinking together in East Dorset. Bill used to say all the time, if I ever get to be as bad a drunk as that damn Ebby, I'll quit. And Ebby used to say, if I ever get to be as bad a drunk as that damn Bill Wilson, I'm going to quit. And Ebby was embarrassing his father because it was election time, just like it is now. And his father said to him, you're going to blow this election for me, Ebby. You've got to get out of here. I want you to go to the summer home in East Dorset, Vermont, and get it fixed up because we're coming out there. And Ebby goes to the summer home in East Dorset, Vermont, and starts painting one of the walls. And some pigeons were doing something on the side of the wall that he didn't like. So he got his shotgun out and started shooting his shotgun at the pigeons. And the neighbors are not crazy about that behavior, so they call the police. And Ebby is put on probation. Not long after that, Ebby drove right through somebody's house. He's drunk again, no surprise there, and he drives into someone's house, gets out of the car, and says to the woman of the house, get me a cup of coffee, Toots. Ebby is brought by the police before the judge, and he is to be remanded to the Vermont State Insane Asylum for the treatment of alcoholism. Now, Roland Hazard and Seber Graves Jr. are practicing the Oxford movement, the Oxford group tenets. One of the tenets of the Oxford group is to give testimony. See if this sounds familiar. To share what has been given you with others so that they may find it too. Roland and Seber Graves Jr. go before the judge and ask the judge if they might take Ebby to the Oxford group in New York at the Cavalry Mission so that he can find what has been so freely given them. So Seber Graves Jr. and Roland Hazard go to the judge, whose name is Seber Graves Sr. Is it odd or is it God? They go to the judge, and the judge remands Ebby to their care on strict probation that if Ebby violates what they tell him to do, he is to go back and to serve out his sentence in the Vermont State Insane Asylum. Ebby goes into the Oxford group, Oxford movement, at the Cavalry Mission. And after several months of his sobriety, because he too is staying sober by working the Oxford group tenets and the Oxford group principles, he is staying sober for several months, and they say to Ebby, you now must give testimony. And he says, I don't want to go give testimony. What are you, nuts? Oh, I'm not giving no testimony. And they said, oh, really? Would you like to go back to Vermont? He says, I think I'll give some testimony. Well, he thinks, who can he talk to in New York where he can give this testimony and he won't embarrass himself? And he thinks about the only guy in New York City that's a worse drunk than him, that's a bigger bum than him, and he thinks about Bill Wilson. So let's find out where we go. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I can remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped, because Bill had heard about what was going on. Of course he would have dinner with me, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, the very thing an oasis. Drinkers are like that. I don't know about you, but I had binge buddies. People that I could really eat with. Not BS eat, but I mean get right down to it. They weren't going to say anything to me, and I wasn't going to say anything to them. But we did massive, I see some laughing, we did massive, massive eating together. And it was not as embarrassing because the other person was doing it too. And so that was what Ebby and Bill, that was the basis of a lot of their relationship. Okay? The door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly, and said, I've got religion. So I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men, that would be Seabrook Graves Jr. and Roland, had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action that was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. Hopeless is not a bad place to be, because when I'm hopeless, I become more teachable. Okay. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proper temperance plunge. I never signed my grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folks in their doing. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen, his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died, these recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. So Bill is hearing about this religious idea, and he doesn't like it. He doesn't like being told what to do. He doesn't like having religion crammed down his throat, or so he thinks. He knows he doesn't want it crammed down his throat. He thinks that this is religious, but what it's going to turn into in a second here is something else. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitations, but that was as far as I had gone. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love and superhuman strength and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. The wars which had been fought, the burnings, the chicanery, the religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. And we could say that today. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe, and since the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. Now, the next paragraph is key, because it's going to change the course of the world that we live in. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point. point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead. Suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Unbelievable paragraph there. It's promises, it's lots of different things. What his friend was sitting and telling him is that there was no way that he could have stopped drinking on his own. There was no way that he could have resurrected his life on his own. There was no way that he could have put himself in the position of being sober and his skin was glowing by himself. That God, without saying it, God had done for him what he could not do for himself. And there's another promise here. It says, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. If that isn't a promise of this program, I don't know what is. And that's true for me and hopefully for you. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him. And there was in me at that moment. And that was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the table. He shouted great tidings. Stop looking for the burning bush. I came in here looking for the burning bush. I came in here looking for movie stars and sexually clad women to come through my window at night and have their way with me. I came into this program thinking that if I gave a little, I'd get a lot. Or if I gave a little, I'd get something. And I found something out. I found out that it doesn't work that way. I resented the thing about God. The thesis line in the whole book, boys and girls, is on page 44, where it says the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And I resisted that. Because God didn't seem to remember me. I'm sure that in the synagogue I attended as a child, they talked of a merciful God. I'm sure that in the synagogue they talked of a loving, wonderful God, but that information never seemed to get to me. What I was presented with was a God that, in my opinion, was very hard to get to, was extremely difficult to please, and had it in for me and wouldn't give me what I wanted. There are two things I need to know about God. And only two. There is one, and it's not me. Those are the things that I need to know about God. And what Bill is learning is to forget about the musty past. Forget about the Red Sea. There's going to be wars. There's going to be all these various things. But here, sitting at the table next to him or across from him is a man who is a drunk, who was hopeless. Society was going to lock Ebby up in an insane asylum, and he was sitting there sober. My God, look around you today. Look at your faces. I wish you could see what I see. I wish you could see what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at a room full of sick, compulsive overeaters. I don't know what's going on in your head. I don't know what's going on in your heart or what your intentions are, but there's not one of you, not one of you, compulsively overeating at this minute. We're in Glendale, California. When I was a little boy and people would come out to California on a business trip or for some reason or whatever, people would gather around and listen to them tell the tales of... No, no snow in the winter, and all the girls looked like Annette Funicello, and you know, we would listen to them talk as if we had been witnessing Moses coming down from the mountain or something, whatever it was. And here we are. Here we are. It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon. There's a thousand things that we could be doing, and yet here is a room full of people that have chosen to put those things aside. Those sirens calling you to the rocks out there, and you have chosen to come here to be together with other recovering compulsive overeaters. Now, if this is not a miracle, then I don't know what is. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. Sorry about that. Antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. The world is about to be changed here. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that opened the door for tens of millions of sick, suffering, compulsive overeaters, alcoholics, gamblers, drug addicts, you name it. When you really think about it, I've never had much trouble with my conception of anything. But now that I'm allowed to give God that definition that I was never allowed to give in my religion, now can I absorb what you're doing? Now can I be a part of what you're putting together? You bet I can. You bet I can. Because if this is going to be a spiritual program, I'm going to confuse it with a religious program. But if you keep telling me that it's God as I understand God, then all I'm going to need to begin is willingness. I have to be willing to believe that God can. And I am absolutely being convinced in the first four chapters in the doctor's opinion that I can't. The first four chapters of this book are steps 1 and 2. I must be convinced that I can't before I will be convinced I need something else. My first mentor in this program pounded this in my head. You gotta be out of ideas, he'd say. You out of ideas, kid? He'd say, as long as you're holding on to ideas on how you're going to do this yourself on your terms, you're wasting my effing time. And he used like golf words and not so nice words, but that's the clean version. Anyway, that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. And the next paragraph is in italics. It must be important. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. Lots of promises here. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me for a brief moment. I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him is in capitals, with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly within myself. Excuse me, and so it had been ever since. How blind I had been. I will blind myself by thinking I didn't get what I want. I will blind myself by thinking I deserve more than I got. I will blind myself with jealousy. Oh, look what she got. Oh, look what he got. I have to give God a chance. I have to give God a chance to work his miracles. Okay. At the hospital, now this is going to be the third hospitalization, and Bill, Evie came to see Bill in November. Bill attended Oxford group meetings in late November of that year and December of that year. Even though he was still drinking, he was going to the Oxford group meetings, and now he is about to go into the hospital for his final hospitalization, the third of three. Excuse me. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. Now let's see the next few paragraphs. We're going to see Bill working the steps in the town's hospital. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. So we're seeing Bill working the first three steps right there in the town's hospital. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins. Ruthlessly facing your sins was one of the Oxford group tenets, and that means he is facing his sins. He is doing what we know today as four. Step four in the town's hospital. Having and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7. In the town's hospital, I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me, that's Ebby. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. 8. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. 9, 10. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. So we see him working right there, the first 10 steps of what we know today as Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he didn't go to these people in the hospital, but he's working through the willingness, he's working through the list that he's going to be doing. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. Step 11. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. 11. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, and that would be in great measure. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have all the elements of a way of living which solved all my problems. Not some, not all my problems, not a few. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light, who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but His impact on me was sudden and profound. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. This is Dr. Silkworth. He's telling Dr. Silkworth what has happened to him in the hospital with Ebby and by himself. Finally, he shook his head. Well, it wasn't by himself. It was with God. Finally, he shook his head saying, "Something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many men who've had such experiences. He knows that they are real. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. Not only is this step 12, but this is very, very important. Because once Bill accepted God, once Bill started to have that spiritual experience, he had a white light in the town's hospital. And when he wrote the book, he put in spiritual experience. And people were writing in and writing in saying, "We're not having that white light. What's going on? What are we doing wrong?" He changed spiritual experience to spiritual awakening in step 12. And he also added appendix 2. If you read in the back of the book, it's appendix 2. And it talks about spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. And one of the things he talks about is you must have the openness, the willingness, and he talks about having a change of personality sufficient enough to bring about a recovery. If I stay the way I was, I will not recover. It's that simple. I must open the door to new ideas. I must open the door to new yeses instead of old no's. But what's very important about this is Bill was a selfish son of a bee. He was an alcoholic. He was a taker. So here he is in the town's hospital, and he is transforming into a giving person and thinking of others without thinking of what they're going to do back for him. I don't know about you. I will give you a dime in my illness. I will give you a dime in my illness. But you better be aware that I am going to knock on your door for a quarter. In this program, I can give, and in the giving alone is the getting. I'm here, you're here, whatever that is. But the bottom line is, he's thinking of others. He's not that selfish drunk anymore. He's changing. So it wasn't just his drinking that's changing. It's his thoughts. It's his actions. Just as the food permeated every fiber of my soul, the recovery permeates every fiber of my soul. And after dinner, we're going to read on page 63, it says, "We were reborn." What a great program. Okay. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. I hope that sounds familiar. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And when I graduated from OA, it's because I stopped doing it. If I stop taking these actions, if I stop doing the things like making the calls, taking the calls, getting to meetings, working the steps, calling my sponsor, having a food plan, if I stop doing that, then I will die. It's that simple. Most relapse starts taking place 60, 90 days before the food goes in the mouth. It's not calling this person anymore. It's not going to that meeting anymore. It's riding around for months with the literature in the back of your trunk without bringing it back to the meeting that you don't go to anymore. It's not turning in the money, just riding it around to make sure it sees all of California. And then lo and behold, pop the food in your mouth. But the food goes in about 60 to 90 days after the work stops. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found, now this is a very important sentence, I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. I have to get out of me. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. I'm talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. We commenced to make many fast friends. Remember we talked about the fair weather friends. Remember we talked about how he became a lone wolf? Well, this is the third reference to it. Only this time he's doing the deal. Only this time he's sober. This time he's going to the Oxford group meetings. And what happens? Him and Lois, commenced to make many fast friends. And a fellowship has grown up among us, which is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set on their feet in the path that really goes somewhere, have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery that has not been overcome among us. In one western city and its environs, there are 1,000 of us in our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. And I believe, just to depart for a second here, the reason Bill puts that in the book is very important to me. And what that means is, just because I'm in recovery, even though I'm in recovery today, I will never rise above the level of human being. And as a human being, I'm going to have challenges. I'm going to have things that are not going to go my way. There are going to be times when I want this, and it turns out that. And what he's telling me here is that even though this guy did that, and that's very discouraging to have the guy commit suicide in his home, he just kept continuing to work the program. And so that's what I need to do too. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath it, there's deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need to look no further for utopia. We have it right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. We're going to break, but before we do, what I'd like you to know, or what I'd not know, but what I'd like you to just look inside here and say, I hope that this is more your story than his story. That you can see you. That you can see who you are through his eyes, through his actions, through the lies that he told, through how he resisted this idea of a God, and how he kept drinking, and all these various diets that he went on. That's the magic of this, that the story is timeless, and that the story transcends personality and becomes the story of us all. And that's the real magic of Bill Sterner. Let's break it and we'll pick it up.